You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 3, today we are in Pontivy.
Yeah, it's always, let's say, nervous and crazy with all the starts of the Grand Tour, especially with parkours like this. We came through, and today the same goal, just to still be there and don't lose it.
Is this crazier for you than the last openings to the tours that you've done? Is this the craziest one?
Probably, yes. I was really thinking I never really start the Grand Tours like that, or normally they start with the prologues or time trials more easy bunch sprint stages. But starting like this was quite a challenge, especially because I was out with no races for quite a while. And quite interesting then to come and start like this.
Well, that was Primoz Roglic talking to Kate Wagner, who's sitting beside me here in the beautiful town of Josselin. Roglic speaking in happier times at the start this morning in Lorient, because a very, very dramatic day, lots of crashes, lots to pick over tonight. But Kate, you got your long-awaited interview with Primoz Roglic this morning.
Yeah, that's true. It's hard to talk about now, knowing what happened later, no spoilers, but not great for him. Yeah, it's funny spending so much time writing and thinking and talking about Roglic and having chats over Zoom and email and whatnot, and seeing him in real life, it's like, it's kind of normal, actually. We were quite chuffed to see each other, I think, and it was the happiest part of the day. He was in a good mood today, actually.
I think it was the happiest part of the day for him as well. We're here with Francois Thomas as well. Hello, Francois.
Hi there.
Francois, we are in the, if there was sun, we'd be in the shadow of the castle. There is no sun. It's quite chilly. But we're by a beautiful river in Josselin with the castle right beside us here. And the race actually came through here today.
Mm-hmm. It's a canal as well.
Oh, so I do apologize.
Yeah, but never mind. Yeah, no, it's a nice, the Josselin is a very pretty little town with a huge and impressive castle. Actually, looking at the history of the castle, nobody knows really why, and it was built. It was built around the 13th century, and then later in the 15th and 16th century became a kind of Renaissance castle. But in the first place, it was actually built around a chapel, and in that chapel was a pilgrimage at the time, at Notre Dame des Ronciers was called, and apparently the people who were going to that pilgrimage were going into a trance and were uttering hoarse cries like some of the riders probably did today, and they were called the Barkers of Josselin. So quite a place.
Will we fall into a trance during the recording of tonight's podcast? It's very possible, although maybe not actually, because we've had two very dramatic days on the tour. Kate, it's your first Tour de France, and I was telling you, wasn't I, that today was going to be a boring day, that not a lot was going to happen today. Finally, we would get a sprint stage, and it would be all about a bunch sprint, and hopefully there wouldn't be too much drama. And we were kind of craving a bit of a boring day, but it was not a boring day. And this often does happen on the tour, where you think that it could be a pretty straightforward routine day, and it definitely isn't, and it definitely wasn't, and it was not an uncontroversial day either. We're going to hear from a few riders in tonight's episode, including maybe one or two of our audio diarists. But the tale of the etape, we began in Lorient, in the far west of France. Obviously, Francois explained the irony of that last night. We went to Pontivy, where I gathered David Lapartion was born.
Absolutely.
Audrey Cordon-Rigaud is from there as well, and she featured in today's episode of Kilometre Zero, all about Brittany, telling us what to do in Pontivy. We were actually, in the end, a bit too busy to do any of those things, but never mind. 182.9 kilometres. Can we just call it 183 kilometres, do you think? Let's round it up. 183 kilometers. Break went early. Yeli Walais from Cofidis, Mikael Schaar from AG2R Citroën, Ida Skelling for the third day in a row up in the breakaway from Bora Hansgrohe, and Maxime Chevalier and Cyril Bart from B&B. They got away early and quickly built a lead. There was drama at 37 kilometres into the race when there was a crash right at the front of the bunch. As the riders went over a speed bump, Geraint Thomas was the first rider down. Didn't get a great view of it, but he came down heavily. Tony Martin came down too from Jumbo-Visma, and Robert Hessink. And Robert Hessink was out of the race immediately. A very important lieutenant for Primoz Roglic, gone. It looked like Geraint Thomas was going to be out as well. He was on the road for a long, long time, but eventually got back up. He had a dislocated shoulder. The race doctor popped his shoulder back in. That makes it sound simple. It was anything but. I spoke to Seb Piquet at the finish, who said that when he passed him, his face was white, and he was obviously in a lot of pain. But he was at 1.2 kilometres behind the race, but he was escorted back by Luke Rowe, Dylan Van Baarle and Jonathan Castrovieco. They averaged, according to one stat I saw, 49.6 kilometres for 10 kilometres to chase the bunch, because the bunch was not hanging around. I understand Luke Rowe was not a very happy rider at all, and was making his unhappiness pretty clear to the commissaire and Thierry Gouvenou. I think he mistakenly thought there was a barrage whereby the vehicles are held from behind the bunch. That wasn't apparently the case, but they had a very hard chase to get back on, which is kind of surprising. Perhaps the bunch didn't know that Geraint Thomas and his teammates were chasing. Who knows? Just a little update on Luke Rowe. As we were recording, we heard that he had been fined 300 Swiss francs and docked 20 UCI points for assault, intimidation, insults, threats and improper conduct. We understand that was for his behaviour towards the chief commissar and the race director, and it was while he and his teammates were chasing to get Geraint Thomas back on. Ida Skelling, who we'll hear from a bit later on, he went for the King of the Mountains points up the Côte de Cadoudal, where Alejandro Valverde won in 2008. Lionel Burney reminded me today.
One of the classics of Breton cycling.
Skelling stopped at the roadside and waited for the bunch after collecting the points. There he's in the King of the Mountains jersey. There was an intermediate sprint. Caleb Ewan won that from the bunch ahead of Mark Cavendish and Mikhail Morkov. And we fancied that was a little preview of the finish. That wasn't to be. And then the final sort of half hour of the race was really marred by a series of terrible crashes, tight technical twisting roads, and Laurent Valentin Madouas from Groupama FDJ came off one of the first crashes on these narrow roads. And then a kilometre or so later on, Primoz Roglic, who appeared to be shoved by Sonny Colbrelli, again riding near the front where it's supposedly the safest place, came down heavily, landed on his bottom, and was pretty banged up and ripped up, and had a hard chase and never got back on, and lost just over a minute on the front group, 50 odd seconds to Tadej Pogacar, the rider who's his main rival here. Then with 4 kilometers to go, with Matej Mohoric on the front of Bahrain Victorious, his teammate Jack Haig was among several fallers on a really kind of dangerous looking narrow bit of road, a left-hand turn. Haig went down. Haig's been riding exceptionally well. That's his tour over. We came to the sprint. It was a small group, and when you see a small group like that coming to the line, you tend to think it's going to be a bit safer. Mathieu van der Poel, yesterday's winner in the yellow jersey, did a fantastic job for his Alpes and Fenix team, leading it out for a while. And then there was a great little train in front of Tim Merlier. He won the stage, but behind him, Caleb Ewan, just as he was about to pull the trigger, having got himself into a good position, he kind of inexplicably crashed very heavily, brought down Peter Sagan, who never crashes. Sagan was straight back up, but Ewan, who kind of slid sickeningly across the road, has broken his collarbone, and he too is out of the Tour de France. So a day of real carnage. Tim Merlier, his win overshadowed, really, because second day in a row, Alpes and Fenix, not a World Tour team, but having a fantastic season. They won again with a 1-2, in fact, because Jasper Philipsen, his teammate, was second. Nasser Bouhanni was third. Davide Ballerini was fourth. Understand Mark Cavendish didn't sprint because he lost some or broke some spokes in one of the crashes. So he was not involved in the crash, but or not, he didn't come down, but out of contention. Sonny Colbrelli was fifth. Julian Alaphilippe was sixth. And a few of the GC guys made it into that front group. Enric Mas and Richard Carapaz were really the big winners. Wilco Kelderman, once again, was up there. Tadej Pogacar lost 26 seconds to that front group, but he's gained over 50 seconds on Primoz Roglic. On GC, still Matthew van der Poel leads Julian Alaphilippe. Richard Carapaz moved up 15 places to third. Wout van Aert is up to fourth. Wilco Kelderman is fifth. And Pogacar dropped 3 places to sixth. In the points jersey, it's Julian Alaphilippe. King of the Mountains, Skelling still. Young Riders jersey, Pogacar. Who's winning the team competition? It's Bahrain victorious, despite having lost Jack Haig today.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2021 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much indeed to Super Sapiens, who are our title sponsor. We're very, very grateful to them for their support. And a little reminder that we are running a competition with Super Sapiens to win 3 months worth of Super Sapiens sensors. If you have any kind of cycling goal or any kind of life goal that you want, that you think Super Sapiens continuous blood glucose monitoring could help you with, then please send us in an audio clip of less than 60 seconds and there'll be 3 lucky winners from this Tour de France. Let's hear the first entry in our competition. From Richard Hunter.
Hi chaps, I'd really love to win the subscription to the Super Sapiens system, and I'm obviously really interested in this product. I'm a very keen cyclist and I ride many miles every week. This product interests me because I have cystic fibrosis. Apart from my lung issues, CF impacts the pancreas, which, as you know, is key when it comes to glucose and blood sugar. My pancreas doesn't work properly. This means that when I eat, the pancreas just tends to sit back and relax rather than releasing insulin straight away. When it eventually wakes up, it floods my body with insulin, causing me to bonk, especially on the bike. This product would really help me monitor when this happens and finally help me come up with a plan on when to fuel rather than just guessing, which is what I've been doing for years. I usually end up taking lots of gels on a ride just to combat the dreaded bonk, so I'd love to know at what point I should refuel in. Anyway, great podcast and I hope to win. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your entry, Richard, and the best of luck to you. I found listening to that pretty moving, and I hope you're one of our winners. But there's still a long way to go in this Tour de France. If you would like to enter our competition, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and, as I say, send us a clip of 60 seconds or less and tell us why and how you would use Super Sapiens. And thank you very much once again to them. Well, chaps, and you've given me permission, Kate, to call you a chap as well, an honorary chap. We were preparing for, you know, a dissection of the first bunch sprint of this year's tour. Not a surprising winner in the end, because he's been one of the best sprinters of the year, and perhaps on his way to Koenig Quickstep for next season, Tim Merlier. But the crashes were really the story of the day, weren't they?
Yeah, well, you know one of the team managers, the most outspoken team managers, the guy who cries and screams and shouts, are the one and only Marc Madiot. I think he kind of summed up in an emotional way probably the impression some of the riders and some of the spectators had at the finish. He was interviewed by French TV as soon as the race ended, and he said, "I'm a family man. I have a son. And after what we saw today, I wouldn't want him to become a professional rider." And he said, "We really need to change something." He didn't accuse anybody. He didn't say it's the UCI, the organizers, the roads, or the riders. But something must be changed, because he said, "If we go on like this, one day there'll be, you know, a dead man. And I don't want to be the manager of a team who has to announce to, you know, his wife that, you know, we're not..." Well, a little bit over the top from Madiot, but in a way, we can understand at the end of such a dramatic day how what pissed off
Arnaud Démare was, his sprinter, Arnaud was Démare, involved yeah, was in a crash as well.
Guys, involved in a crash. So I don't know what you think. I mean, we know that at every start of the tour, Jonathan Waters, who was a little bit less could I say emotional than Marc Madiot, tweeted that it was, in a way, the Tour de France was kind of back to normal, because that's what you see, unfortunately, that's what you see in the first couple of stages in the Tour de France.
I asked Roger Kluger about this at the finish, and you know, his teammate Caleb Ewan had just come down, and he was adamant. Some riders have been pretty outspoken already on social media about the dangerousness of today's stage. Our audio diarist, who we may well hear from tonight, was waiting for his dispatch. Tim de Klerk told Sportza that the riders had requested that the stage, the time be taken at 8 kilometres to go, and that request was not granted. That would set a strange precedent, I think. I mean, it's a really difficult one. If we actually look at the crashes, the bad crashes, Geraint Thomas's crash was not caused by the course being dangerous. Primoz Roglic's crash was not, I don't think, caused by the course being dangerous. You could argue that certainly Jack Haig's crash was having such narrow roads, such twisting narrow roads towards the end of what was a sprint stage, was dangerous. It's always in bike racing, it's a dangerous sport, and it's the riders who make it dangerous too, not just the roads. You know, the ASO have set this precedent for themselves, whereby, you know, they are apparently seeking out the female fan who caused this crash on day one by holding out the banner for her grandparents. She is facing potentially a 1-year prison sentence and a huge fine. And I just think, are they going to sue themselves for the crash involving Jack Haig? Because you could argue that they were culpable for that. Sonny Colbrelli, you could argue, was culpable in the Primoz Roglic crash. The crash involving Geraint Thomas seemed to be a speed bump that caught them unawares. So it's really difficult. You know, I think overall the finale today was really dangerous, and the finish was dangerous too. But again, Caleb Ewan's crash was not caused by the course. It looked like a rider error.
Yeah, hopefully we won't get into legal implications too much. We're not going in to follow that lead that sometimes we get into. I know that Thierry Gouvenou, the guy who's in charge of the course, and you know the sports director. Remember last year in stage one when Thibaut Pinot crashed, and there were lots of crashes, the slippery roads in Nice. The teams these days always seem to want to neutralize the finish or to have a real safe race. I'm not kind of an old school tough guy, you know, but sometimes Thierry Gouvenou sounds like this, like, well, you know, in my day. But once again, the adaptation to the terrain is part of that's what the sport is about. These guys have scouts in every team that, you know, checking the course, checking every stage, checking the terrain. They have briefings in the morning. They know what to expect, and in a way, of course, we all feel miserable when we see these crashes and guys out of contention so early in the race. But once again, this is an outdoor sport. This is France. This is Brittany. This is the roads you get, and you have to adapt to that. It's unfortunate.
I think it's an interesting question, especially in terms of neutralization. Which, if you think about neutralization as kind of like a workplace action, it's kind of an interesting scenario where it's kind of the cycling equivalent to, like, I guess in union speak, like a workplace slowdown, which is a kind of an act of, like, last year, remember on stage one of the Tour de France where Tony Martin, with his arms spread wide, neutralized the race. That was a very provocative thing to do. I mean, it was basically going against the wishes, essentially, of the race organizers. And it was basically all these guys acting together collectively, kind of almost as workers, putting a stop to what they thought was a dangerous situation. And they saw in that moment, I think part of the reason we owe this outspokenness to what happened last year, not only in the Tour, but in the Giro where there was a strike, and in the Vuelta where there was another strike, is that they've gotten a lot more outspoken now because they realize that, like, they actually have some kind of power collectively. And so this comes with the territory. They've kind of become their own activists, which I think ultimately is like a good thing that can inspire change. But again, at the end of a race, like, emotions are high. I mean, Stefan Kreuzweig had some words to mince with the commissaires, and no wonder, it's his teammate and team leader who's down. I think that, you know, when these decisions are made collectively, like that neutralization was, then I think that they can be very powerful gestures. But if the riders are fractured in opinion on what should happen, then nothing is going to get done, and it just ends up this kind of emotional brouhaha. So it really is kind of an all or nothing thing. So we'll see how this happens. You know, things can happen overnight. Like, there can be a protest tomorrow. Like, you never know. But I think it's generally points to sort of an activist turn in the peloton, which the likes of which we haven't seen probably for decades.
Hmm. It's great if the riders, you know, get more outspoken. I've been you know, pleading for that to happen for years and years. This is the only sport in which the you know, the actors are you know, in tennis we know that they took over, you know, in the 70s, the in soccer the players unions are pretty strong, in the American sport, the NBA, the NHL, I mean, all the NFL, you know, the actors of the game took over, and the writers are doing this more and more. That's fine, you know, but once again, what can you do against the terror? And you go to Brittany, you know the kind of roads you're going to, because if we end up doing that, all the finalists, the finalists of the stages will be the same, you know, like big straight roads in industrial zones. I mean, the flavor of the race is at stake as well.
Like I say, if you analyze each crash, in some cases you could say the terrain was at fault, you know, that it was perhaps, and I think it was a dangerous finale, but a lot of the crashes today were not caused by the course being dangerous, and so any kind of protest is you know, we're talking about riders speaking out and having power to effect change, but to change what? I mean, yeah. I think the riders are also very conscious of public criticism too. You know, after a day like today, they have public sympathy on their side, of course. But at the Giro last year, let's not forget the stage where they staged a kind of protest and refused to ride the first bit in terrible weather. That really backfired quite badly on them in the court of public opinion. Yeah. People were not sympathetic.
And I also remember Thierry Gouvenou, once we were discussing the same issue with Gouvenou, and he was saying, well, if they think, you know, they know the terrain pretty soon, once we announce the parcours, they should sue us then, you know, because when they, I mean, they pretty quickly know, check the if there's something they feel is dangerous, they should tell it much, you know, earlier. This way we can act before it happens, you know.
It's interesting to me because another thing that was brought up this morning when I was in the mix zone, I talked to, I didn't talk to you, but I listened to Andrew Hood talk to Mikhail Kwiatkowski, who made a really interesting point, and he said that, like, this is why a prologue is a useful thing to have in the tour, because it's almost like, he's compared it to qualifying in Formula One, where it sets like a clear leader early on, and that makes things a little bit easier going in because there's not the competition for the yellow jersey.
Yeah, sure, but
at the same time, you know, do you want every first stage to be won by a time trialist?
Yeah, but then again, if you have a prologue, you have a boring first week because you know the yellow jersey stays with the same team. You have a couple of easy sprints, and there's no action. I mean, I don't want to sound, you know, but if you, in terms of drama, intensity of action, the first 3 days in Brittany with Alaphilippe winning on the first day, Mathieu van der Poel avenging Poulidor's curse, and unfortunately what we saw today in terms of, you know, the drama of the race, you wouldn't have this with a prologue, with a guy you know, leading the way until the next time trial or until the mountains. I mean, I've covered the tour in the 1980s. It was 10 days, 15 days sometimes of boring flat stages.
With long launches, yeah. Though, Francois.
That's right, yeah. Jean-Paul Van Poppel winning winning endlessly, you know, or Cipollini. And all of a sudden, the action would start at the start of the third.
Kate hasn't got to that period yet. give her a chance. I think it's funny. It's been interesting for me to sort of see it through your eyes a bit today, Kate, because it's your first tour, and we have seen a lot of bloodied and you know, battered riders. Tony Martin, the image of him crossing line today, having obviously fallen very heavily on day one, and then again today, looking like a sort of a fighter who'd gone, a bare knuckle fighter who'd gone 15 rounds with the world champion. He looked sort of, he had the 1,000-yard stare. You can't help but be sort of moved by that. I think you've been very moved by the sight of riders in so much pain. And I don't know if we're inured to it, as you said, but you certainly, what one thing that is that does become apparent on the tour is that you move on really quickly. So we had that terrible day of carnage on Saturday, but nobody was talking about that yesterday. We were talking about Matthew van der Poel, and tomorrow we'll be talking about something else. We move on, we talk, and this is one of the things that makes cycling a brilliant sport to write about and to revisit, because you move on so quickly that a lot of stories kind of get left behind. But in a rarely prescient move for me this morning, I was interested in this business of crashes, because modern crashes seem to take out more riders. And I don't know if that's because they're going faster, whether they're riding closer together, or what it is. And I spoke to Chris Yule Jensen of Team Bike Exchange about it this morning. And, well, I thought what he said was quite interesting on this subject.
So far, did you manage to avoid the crashes on stage one?
Yeah, I have up until now. I mean, pretty horrible big crashes, especially the second one looked real bad. So, yeah, it was just a classic day one of the tour, really. We all sort of expected it, hoped it wouldn't happen, but, it happened twice. And today will also be very hectic, especially the finish descent until the final 3K. Could be wet. So it's the tour one is at its best, really, and there's a big difference between doing, now I've done the Giro earlier this year and doing the tour. I mean, the stress factor is actually, it's so obvious. It's just an example of why this race is the biggest race there is.
Is that a factor in the crashes involving so many people? This seems to be a relative new feature. Is that just the speed? Is it the fact that riders are bunching closer together?
I think it's just a combination of many things. I mean, I think the first crash we saw on day one was obviously because of the crowds. So maybe it had a sign that didn't make life easier for us. But in general, there's just more pressure on the roads. There's more stress in the radio. Luckily, on our team, we go about things as if it was any other race. Every rider, every team, they know that this is the biggest scene on the cycling calendar. And especially in the start, everyone's fresh, everyone's together. Last year was actually quite nice. We had such a hard start climbing-wise because it sort of set the tone very early on. That'll take a few days before that happens here, and I think everyone's looking forward to that.
And the crowds and the noise from the crowds, maybe you're not as used to that after last year.
No, but, personally, I'm happy to, it's great to see and hear the crowds back. It's unfortunate that one person has to ruin it for everyone else because, in general, people are just happy to be out and following a bike race again. I think the majority of the peloton feel the same way. But that also hasn't influenced on the stress and the bunch, the noise and the amount of people on the side of the roads, there's not really room to budge.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2021 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the cycling podcast. If you would like to get 25% off all your Science in Sport products, and who wouldn't, go to scienceofsport.com. Enter the code SISCP25. SISCP25. Just looking through my messages today from Lionel. Get a lot of messages from Lionel, so I have to scroll back quite a bit. Lionel is preparing to come out to the Tour de France next week, and rest assured, listeners, he's paying close attention. He's certainly watching it very closely indeed. So we ran the first Super Sunday competition with Science and Sport yesterday. A lot of people went for Matthew van der Poel. We didn't, but a lot of our listeners did. And the first correct answer out of Lionel's cycling podcast casket was Alison Timmins. Alison, congratulations. You will get £80 worth of Science and Sport goodies. I think we'll get in touch with you and arrange for delivery. Sunday's competition, that's the stage up to Teen in the Alps, is now open. Predict the winner and being with a chance of winning. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to enter that competition. I should also mention that today we released the first of our 15 episodes of Kilometre Zero during this Tour de France. It's all about Brittany, and we hear from David Godou, Connor Swift, who we're going to hear from a bit later on, and Audrey Cordon-Ragot, and also Francois Thomazeau. Tomorrow's episode is about the Tour de France Femme, the new 8-day stage race that will launch next year, with a bit of a lament for La Course as well. So the big talking points today, I mean, I feel this is one of the unfortunate things. We're probably not going to talk about Tim Merlier and Alps and Fenix an awful lot, because the tour was sort of set on a different course today, we feel. I mean, Primoz Roglic has released a message tonight that he's okay. He's got no broken bones. He's okay to carry on, he thinks. Geraint Thomas, the same. There's just been a message come through from Ineos Grenadiers to say that he's had a post-stage scan and x-ray. They were clear, and he has not suffered a fracture in his right shoulder. He will be reassessed in the morning before stage four. I think back to the Giro last year when Geraint Thomas crashed on stage three, also on stage three, and he finished the stage and then didn't start the next day. Let's hope it's not the same. But, and you know, in the end today, he did all right. He didn't lose too much time. He actually moved up two places on GC. He's 18th overall. But the after effects of suffering a dislocated shoulder are bound to affect him, especially in the time trial in a couple of days, which kind of looms, and it will affect, I'm sure, Geraint Thomas and Primoz Roglic, even if they are okay to carry on.
The strange thing about this Tour de France, the, you know, start, Grand Départ in Brittany, is that already, you know, it's kind of skimmed the field, you know, the GC contenders. There was lots of talk before the start of the Tour de France about the four-man lead in Ineos Grenadiers.
The one-pronged fork. It's a chopstick.
Now we've got exactly Richard Carapaz. It may change again in the course of the Tour. Of course, it's a long race. But it seems now that, you know, he is third overall, some 31 seconds, I think, behind Mathieu Van Der Poel. He seems to be now the de facto leader of the team. I mean, Geraint Thomas might whatever happens, you know, is bound to suffer from this dislocated shoulder. Richie Porte lost lots of time. Theo Gegenhardt is out of contention. Well, let's face it, you know, in the only 3 days what was one of the big stories of the pre-tour is kind of gone. And then for Rog, as we might call her, I'll let Kate talk about it, because she's the
she's our Rog correspondent. Kate, what can you tell us about Rog? What he is tough. He has crashed before. He's crashed quite a lot, and you know, we think that his crash at Dauphiné last year did affect his bid to win the tour last year. Of course, they kind of underplayed that at the time, but I think the documentary that came out just before Christmas, inside Team Jumbo Visma, really laid bare how much that did affect him. And here, he's going to hurt, isn't he? And that's going to, we were talking last night about how he was following Pogacar everywhere, but he's lost time. And in last year, the thing that maybe helped Pogacar win the tour in the end was the fact that he lost time in the crosswind stage. But there's a big difference between losing a minute in a crosswind stage and falling on your bottom and being injured and then carrying those injuries into the next few stages.
Definitely don't think he looks great. I was there at the mix zone and I watched him cross the line, and yeah, it was really hard to see, honestly, after spending so much time writing and thinking about him. And yeah, he was bloody from the buttocks, bloody from the leg. He had like a 1,000-yard stare, just like you said. He looked like he got out of the ring with Mike Tyson. Really terrible. And when I was watching the stage, I mean, his teammates were forming a train to bring him back. And, you know, there were times where he would lose their wheel. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's a hard man, I think, at heart. He's kind of got nerves of steel. And I think that he's going to go as long as he can. I mean, I think we'll probably know more answers by the end of the time trial. But until then, I'd say it's up in the air. If it really is just a flesh wound, like, I think, you know, he'll grit his teeth, grit and bear it. I mean, the parts of him that hurt are not necessarily the parts that he's not, like, that hurt on, like, you know, his arms and his elbows, anything that causes him to fidget in the time trial bike. So it might be interesting to see. I think that's really the proving ground for a lot of guys who have been injured so far. So it's all resting on that.
We often talk about the luck of the winner, you know, in the Tour de France, and Tadej Pogacar actually crashed. Well, at least he was involved in the Jacquet crash at that turn, but he was quickly back on his bike. And this sometimes sorts, you know, outsorts the future winner from the other guys. Some guys don't crash, or when they crash, it's not. And it's very difficult to know why. I mean, is it because of luck, or is it because of form, or is it because of? It's very difficult to tell. But I mean, it's a common thing that you know. For now, the luck of the winner has been, on Pog's side and not on Roglic's side.
It's really unusual to win the Tour de France having crashed in the race. It's really, really unusual. I mean, Chris Froome did it in 2013, having crashed in the neutralized zone of stage one. But it's really, really unusual. And I think we're learning more about how crashes affect a rider. I mean, an extreme example is Lizzie Banks, and I mentioned the other day our episode that we released of Service Course last week, where Lizzie talked for 50 minutes about the concussion that she suffered at Strade Bianche and the after effects of that and the process of trying to recover fully from that. Crashes take it out of you. We've heard it from James Knox in one of his audio diaries as well. Not an easy thing to deal with. You know, it affects your sleep, it affects your recovery, it affects your nervous system, and really, really hard, a real given that it's such a common occurrence in professional cycling, and it's an ever-present danger and risk, the consequences can be really, really severe. And yeah, it's you know, we're only 3 days in, which is amazing, and there has been this skimming, and this, I think, from a sporting point of view, we were really looking forward to this battle between these two strong individuals, Roglic and Pogacar, against the collective might of Ineos Grenadiers, and we've been deprived of that already. But that's part of the sport, and we'll get something else instead. Shall we hear from one of our audio diarists, Connor Swift from Arkea Samsic, whose team leader Nairo Quintana is riding extremely well. He often surprises us, and maybe it's not a surprise anymore, but he seems to handle himself really well in technical, you know, crosswinds and technical finishes and so on, and he is currently eighth overall, looked good on the Tour de Bretagne, and they also had Nasser Bouhanni up there today, Arkea Samsic.
Another crazy stage to start things off. Obviously the weather was a bit bizarre today. We rode through some big showers. Everyone started the race with pretty much a rain cape in the pocket, and then we went through some patches of some big downpours, and then I'd say things kind of kicked off the crazy bit of the stage when G hit the deck, you know, with like 144k to go. We was riding by the coastline there, and just to see him on the ground, middle of the stage, it was just, it just puts everyone, you know, back into that nervous bit of racing mode. Yeah, that wasn't nice to see, and obviously hope he's all good there. Even before the race, we said in the briefing today, just because of what happened the day before, you know, teams were lined up and the row was pretty much blocked before the final lap of the circuit on stage two, with a good 50-60k to go. If you wasn't on the front of your team, like three, four rows back, you just couldn't move anywhere. So we said in the briefing today that it's probably going to be the same sort of thing that happens today. You know, with the last 20k being super narrow rows, twisty. So we was anticipating that, and yeah, what do you know, after the intermediate sprint today, with around 60-odd k, 70-odd k to go, straight after that sprint, teams were there, lined up at the front, just as we expected. And yeah, from then on, it was just crazy, you know, people fighting for position. If you're on the front, then yeah, you're pretty sweet and safe and sound. But anyone behind, you know, you leave the littlest bit of a gap, or there is a little bit of a gap, people are trying to take it, you're bouncing off of each other, and it's just pretty crazy, especially if you lose your teammate's wheel. And then yeah, going into the final few K, obviously there was a massive crash. We was on tight, narrow roads, and big old crash there with, I don't know, 10k to go or so. And then the same thing again with 5K to go. It's not great and it's not nice. And then obviously again on the last corner with Ewan and Sagan, it's awful to see and just crazy. I feel like after riding the Tour last year, I can't think it was this, this nervous, but I think the weather doesn't help. And then obviously just the amount of pressure that teams have. There's a lot of people here that have kind of wrote off the GC plans, and I'd say there is a lot of sprinters here. There's a lot of sprinters here, and then obviously the GC teams, and everyone just wants to be at the front, and there's not enough road for that. And with 184 riders, it's a big peloton. Crashes, well, they're going to happen, especially on roads like that. I mean, imagine if the final today was on wet roads. I think it'd have been even worse. Luckily for us, not luckily, we had Barguil crash and also Dan McLeay. Them two have lost a bit of skin, and it's the second crash that they've had this tour, and it's not nice to see. And hopefully them two are both okay in the morning. Nairo stayed in that front group, luckily, and then Nasser finished the stage in third, which is obviously nice for us. It's good going ahead into the future sprint stages that he finished third today, and we're trying to find that stage win to finish it off. I'd say the peloton does feel a lot more tense and very nervous, and yeah, teams lining up 60-70k to go. That just shows you like the pressure's there, and yeah, it's pretty crazy in the bunch.
That was Connor Swift. You can hear the first installment of our collected audio diaries from our four diarists: Victor Campenaerts, Connor Swift, Ben O'Connor, and Tim de Klerk, in Kilometre Zero on Wednesday. And then I think Kate's first audio diary, first of three audio diaries, will be coming out on Thursday. Although you're recording a lot of stuff, Kate, so maybe it'll be an extended friends special after the tour. Who knows? Just keep recording. It's all good stuff. But yeah, the writers that I mentioned have been sending in lots of audio every day, and so this will be edited down into an audio diary that will come out on Wednesday as one of our Kilometre Zero episodes, supported by Super Sapiens. And thanks very much again to them. Thanks as well to Skoda, I should say. I haven't said it yet, but Skoda have once again, I think the fourth year, given us a car. How's the Nest, Francois?
The Nest is fine, actually. Yeah, no, it's
fine.
Great.
Fine.
No, it's. I mean, I've been in so many fine Nests now, you know. But no, this one is okay. I mean, I've got, you know, room for my legs. We're not, you know, overloaded this year. We don't have those. We don't have Lionel's bike.
Lionel takes up a lot of space, eh? Kate's a bit smaller, but we'll have Lionel next week to fit into the car. It's a Skoda Superb. It's huge. The boot is enormous. And it's very, I understand it's very fast. I don't know that, obviously, but I believe it's very fast.
By the end of the tour, we might know. But
No, nonsense. But thank you very much to Skoda UK for giving us a car. We're very grateful to them for their support as well. They've been supporters of the cycling podcast for a few years now. Well, listen, we've got to move on to what you just called the bullshit, Francois. It's not the bullshit. It's the cultural stuff. It's the word of the day. It's the song of the day. It's the cultural highlight of the day. What have you got for us today?
Well, no real bullshit, to be honest. I've got goat's cheese.
I mean,
if we talk about the cheese of the, well, I spent 3 days saying there were no cheese in Brittany, which is kind of true, because there's no like appellation, you know, contrôlée, like a brand of a breed and of cheese from there, but
a cheese that's gone through the French bureaucratic process.
if you would,
I mean, we pasteurize them. You bureaucratize,
yeah, but I think
them.
You have cheddar, and it's cheddar. I mean, it's cheddar and Stilton are two
don't
different
not cheddar.
Cheese, okay, so well, we have the same sort of cheese, but we have lots of different names. But in Britain, they just have goat cheese or cow. But I'm going to tell you, because tomorrow we'll be going near Rennes and all those places, and there's an industrial story called Petit Billy. It's actually it's called so Little Billy, but it has nothing to do with the name of the owner of the cheese company. It started in a place called Billy, and it's in the center of France, in Loire-et-Cher. And they had this idea in the 1980s, like you know, they realized what I've been doing for 3 days, that there was no cheese in Brittany, but there were lots of goats in Brittany, so they moved to Brittany to to get cheese, to get goat's milk, and make a very light white creamy cheese, which is very popular now in supermarkets all around France. So that's the story of Billy, and they also Petit Billy. They also found out that there was I guess it's the same everywhere. There was a kind of anti-cow cheese propaganda, like, oh, it's, cow cheese is bad for you, it's full of fat, it's full of cholesterol and things. So they really put their money on goat's cheese. It's a success. You've clearly found Petit Billy all over France. They've got a website, they've got lots of things. They're really surfing the wave of environment, green foods, all organic and all that stuff. I don't know how sincere they're about. I mean, they're a company, they're an effort to make money. But Petit Billy, when you don't know what to, you go to a supermarket in France, you don't know what kind of cheese you're going to have, it's kind of a safe bet. It's okay. So, and now they're now near Rennes, settled there, and they're now making different kind of cheeses. So Petit Billy, kind of an industrial success story, in Brittany, from a company that started in the center of France. That was the cheese of the day. I guess the word of the day should have been shoot, because we really missed it. And chute in French is funny because chute means crash. It also means, when you say chute, means shh, like please shut up, like chute, shut up. But we'll go. The word we chose for today is Bretagne, because we've used that word a lot. So, but what is Bretagne? What is Brittany? What is this place? It's very odd because actually you know what the original Bretagne was. That's the place where the Bretons lived. So originally, it's a place now called Britain, that the Breton, Breton, and in French, we call Britain Grande Bretagne. And it was actually the original Brittany was Britain. Mm. And guys from Wales, crossed in the 5th century because there was a big plague. They crossed over the channel and settled in what was called before that Armorica, And it suddenly became Brittany because Bretons, settled there. And the funny thing about Brittany is that nobody agrees on where it starts and when it finishes. Even in France, take Nantes, it's a big town, and this is where you have the castle of Anne de Bretagne, of Anne of Brittany. So normally it should be in Brittany. But lots of Bretons say, oh, no, Nantes is not in Brittany. So if you go south, where does Bretagne start and where does Bretagne ends, nobody knows. If you go east and go to Normandy, there's a kind of an agreement that Mont-Saint-Michel is the border between Normandy and Brittany. But
there's a fight, isn't there, over
of course, but where does Bretagne start and where does Bretagne finishes, nobody knows. So Bretagne as such, and Brittany is a very vague concept, originally. So you listeners who live in Britain, you're actually living in the original Bretagne, no? And now there's a new Bretagne, and nobody knows for sure what it is.
Well. It does feel, it does have a different vibe to it, Brittany, Bretagne. And the people here feel themselves to be different, don't they? As we heard from Audrey Cordon-Rigaud, they might not do cheese, Francois, but they do biscuits and they do butter, salted butter, and galette. And she did tell us that when we were in Pontivy today, we should have visited the La Biscuiterie Joubert, the famous biscuit factory where you can just fill up your bags with biscuits. But unfortunately, there was rather a lot going on at the finish today, so it was tricky to do that.
And that's another thing we must mention. We mentioned this guy before, but today we went through Radenac at kilometer 121. But that was in the heart of the action. There were already been a couple of crashes, and it was far too much action to mention. But we went through the birthplace of Jean Robic, and this is the
old Leatherhead,
of course. Yeah, the place where we are now. This area is Jean Robic.
Did we not establish that he was actually born in the Ardennes, but he grew up here?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. But he spent his youth in Radenac.
Correct, his
family, his mother, everybody.
Yeah, his family.
But he actually grew up there. He was born in the Ardennes, and then came to back to his family birth, and so you've got a whole circuit now of for Grand Fondos and greenways named after Jean Robic. He really is the cycling hero of the area.
Well, we're going to play out with their song before we go. Actually, tonight though, it's been a tough day, a really difficult day for lots of riders and teams, but one rider, like a ray of sunshine, not Wilco Kelderman, although he also is still worthy of a mention because he's still there in fifth, and he's had a pretty incident-free race so far. Is he increasingly your pick, Kate?
Yes, just for, if not for banter, then for, well, I mean, okay, so I said previously I talked to Wilco two times, one in the presser and one in on the mix zone, and he was extremely confident both times, very easy, shoulders relaxed, like big, broad voice. He says, I'm confident in my GC, you know, like he's like a very, he seems in good spirits. And even, you know, he definitely has proven he's third in the Giro. I think, I mean, if he can't, I don't necessarily know if he can win it, but I certainly think with this now very thinned out field, let's be really honest here. I mean, a podium is certainly within the realm of possibility for him. And his team is still strong. Aside from Sagan, they've had no incidents.
Well, indeed, last man standing. But the best way to avoid incident is to be up the road. And one rider who's been in every breakaway so far, Ida Skelling. We spoke to him at the finish. He seems to be enjoying himself. And obviously, he's in that King of the Mountains jersey still.
You look like you're having a lot of fun in this Tour de France.
Yeah, well, I am. So you saw that, right?
Is it? I mean, you get in the breakaway every day. Is that? Are you finding that quite easy to do?
Well, it's never easy, especially the first 2 days it wasn't. But today it was a bit easier. And well, I've had some experience in my SEG years, but my former team. But still, it's hard, and I'm tired now. But hopefully, the coming 3 days will be a bit easier for me.
I guess it's the safest place to be as well.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, up front of the peloton and in the final, I did some work for my teammates in the early final, and then I could just drop myself. So that's indeed the most safe spot, and I hope everyone is okay, or sort of okay, because I saw Caleb going into the hospital car. Yeah, I'm happy that I could avoid all these crashes. Well, I think the jersey I can keep now till the seventh day, because tomorrow there are no KM points, the day after Arsenal, and the day after that only one. So I reckon I could keep it for quite a while now. So that's also why I went for it today. If I only would do it for one more day, then I don't think it would be worth my energy. But as I can keep it now for another 3 days, it was worth my energy. And of course, my legs are getting tired now.
So we thought we'd finish on a bit of a positive note. Ida Skelling is, at least, he was still smiling at the finish today, even if lots of others weren't. So we limp on to tomorrow. What's the song of the day, Francois? Will that cheer us up as well?
Well, I don't know if I actually changed my song of the day, because we'll be going pretty close to Rennes tomorrow, which is the capital of Britain, you can say. And as a very famous singer from Rennes called Etienne Dao is known in Britain a bit as well, because he hooked up quite a bit with Saint Etienne, famous
great band.
Yeah, great band. And he's very, very popular in Rennes and very popular in France. And one of his don't see any irony in that, but one of his greatest hits was called Tombé pour la France, meaning, you know, fallen for France. And I see this song as kind of a homage to all the guys who today, you know, crashed for the Tour de France. And so, do you want me? Well, I don't have my guitar, so I have to do an a cappella rendition of it. I'll do the best
We're
I can.
We're open to that.
Okay.
We're all ears.
Okay, 1, 2, 3. Bibop pieds nus sous la lune, sans foi ni toi ni fortune, je passe mon temps à faire n'importe quoi. Sur les pistes, noires de préférence, quand le démon de la danse me prend le corps, je fais n'importe quoi. Tout va bien. Sur un jerk électronique, se nouent des amours ludiques, bip-hop la vie c'est n'importe quoi, c'est la fête, c'est psychédélique, me demande pas ce que je fabrique, je te répondrai n'importe quoi, j'en sais rien. Dum dira, je m'étourdis, ça ne suffit pas à me faire oublier que t'es plus là. J'ai gardé cette photo sur moi, ce photomaton que t'aimais pas. Si tu viens, n'attends pas que je sois tombé pour la France. That's it.
Whoa! Thank you, Francois.
Very famous song. I mean, you know, you've got lots of synthesizers and drums and stuff in the original version. Look it up on YouTube.
You don't need any of that. Thank you very much to you, Francois. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.